Good afternoon, everybody. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Jenny Lyon. I'm going to be chairing the session today. I think we'll just get started and I'll go through the introduction. So welcome to the session that Adam's going to run for us today. So I, just so that you all know, the sessions are going to be recorded. So if you're going to ask questions and contribute, and we'd encourage that as much as possible, then please say your name and speak into the microphone. I think Adam's going to encourage questions as we go along as well, so please do that. Remember to fill in your forms online, I think it is, the feedback survey. That's about it, I think, but I'll just launch straight into it and introduce Adam. So Adam Roth's been teaching actuarial studies at ANU since 2005. He has a strong interest in education issues and is currently the nominated accreditation actuary for ANU with its accreditation through the Actuaries Institute. He's also been heavily involved in the preparation, delivery and marking of courses for the Actuaries Institute and is currently a member of the Educational Development Group of the Actuaries Institute, which I have particular interest in since I'm chairing it. His interest in actuarial education issues extends to publications on teaching methods in actuarial studies and conference presentations in Australia and the US on the key issues facing actuarial education. The team involved in the research being presented all have long and distinguished careers in actuarial education, which I can confirm. So I think most of us have some interest in the actuarial education process, having been through it ourselves. So I will hand over to Adam and see where we go. Thank you.
I think everyone has an interest in education. Everyone has an opinion on education, and I encourage you to express that opinion both during and after this presentation. I want to learn from you as much as you learn from me. Okay, let's start with an exercise then. Interaction is fun. I find it quite boring to listen to someone speak for half an hour sometimes, unless they're a really good speaker. So if you've got a mobile device, I encourage you to, well, you can't really click on that link, can you? But I encourage you to type that link into your browser and answer the question, and we'll have a look at the responses later on. The question that you're going to answer is one of the questions that was asked in the survey that I'm going to present, and I'm just interested to see how the results of the people in this room compare to the results of the survey that I'm going to talk about. This is not formal research, though, so I'm not using the results of this survey for anything other than entertainment value during this presentation. Okay, a couple of bits of housekeeping first. Jenny mentioned that I am on the Educational Development Group that she's a chair of. Educational Development Group is looking at Part 1 and Part 2 actuarial education in Australia. This is not a presentation from the Educational Development Group. We've passed the results of this on to the Educational Development Group, but I just thought I'd clarify that. I would like to acknowledge my co-authors, David Pitt and Jim Farmer from Macquarie University and Michelle Salmona from ANU. John Evans was also heavily involved in this project in an earlier iteration. This research is based on a grant from the Actuaries Institute. We ran a pilot in 2013 and published that in the Australian Journal of Actuarial Practice in 2014, and we've submitted these results to the Australian Journal of Actuarial Practice, and hopefully it might get published sometime later this year. Now, motivation. I was thinking probably 2 or 3 years ago about how universities and the Institute are pretty good at getting course-level feedback about the courses they run. So every semester I teach a course at ANU, I get a PDF file at the end with the feedback from the students that I've taken saying I'm a fantastic lecturer or I'm a terrible lecturer, often in the same feedback open-ended question. And that's all really, really helpful for my teaching. What I don't think we do a good job of is program-level feedback. So certainly at ANU we don't get feedback from students or from graduates about their view of the program as a whole, and I'm not aware of the Institute doing that either. So that was really the motivation for doing this, is to get a feel from graduates what their view of the actuarial education program was. And when I say graduates, I mean people who have done an actuarial module either through a university or through the Institute in the last 5 years, because they're relatively close to their education. Did anyone in this room do this survey? Okay, let's move on then. Now, there's the project aims. You can all read. I don't really like just reading off slides. So I've described what graduates are already. The push for appropriate changes to be made to education programs, the last point there, I'm not going to talk much about that in this presentation. We've still got more work to do. What the purpose of this presentation is to do is just to present results of the survey, essentially. Here's the project themes, which again, I'll let you read rather than me reading them out. I'll talk through the specific questions we asked when we get to the actual results later on in this presentation. We sent the survey to approximately 1,700 respondents. The reason we don't know, or potential respondents, the reason we don't know exactly how many is that we were able to get access to the Institute's lists, email list, which was fantastic, and also the ANU and Macquarie alumni lists. There's bound to be some overlap between the two. We didn't see the email addresses, anyone on the research team, so we don't know what the overlap was. We sent about 2,250, so 2,250 emails. We're guessing that there was maybe about 500 overlap. We got 287 responses, which is about 17%. That's actually not too bad for this type of research, that response rate. And I'll take you through some demographics in a moment to hopefully prove that the sample is not too biased. We did offer incentives. There was a lottery that you were able to get access to if you filled the survey out, and 10 people won a $200 voucher, including, very unfortunately, someone on ANU staff. But I was, someone was looking over my shoulder as I generated the random numbers. So anyway, we'll move on past that. Yeah, that was terrible when that happened. It was like the last thing I really wanted to happen. But you've got to obey the Excel random number generator. Okay, here's some demographics. I'm going to go through this nice and quickly because the results are far more interesting, but I just want to prove that there's no massive biases in the results. So we ran this survey in 2014. That's the breakdown of the last time someone did an actuarial course. Nothing massively exciting there. Current employment area, isn't that a horrific pie graph? But I couldn't think of a nicer way to present it. Now, there's some small words up there. What I think is interesting about this, if you look at general insurance, consulting and internal, let's use my right hand so it's not so moving around, it's about 25%. That's pretty close to the Institute's breakdown across the whole profession. Now you look at life insurance, consulting and internal, which is here, also around about 25%, also pretty much exactly what the Institute breakdown is. So this is actually quite exciting that our sample is pretty closely aligned to the Institute in terms of where they're working. It's a big other here. The three biggest categories, we asked people to specify what other was. Public servants, that's our ANU graduates. The regulator and data analytics. We first ran this in 2013. If I was running this now, I'd have an option for data analytics. I didn't back then, but I'd say probably about 5% of the respondents were data analytics, because that is where a lot of the younger actuaries are heading nowadays. Okay, employment location, so it's about 70% Australia, and the rest, as you can see there. This other here is probably made up, the two biggest ones were Hong Kong and Thailand. Age, median age is 25 of the sample. Gender, male, female, 60-40, pretty close to the Institute. Neither is there because our human ethics required us to put neither as an option. No one responded neither. This is the breakdown of what level of qualification the respondents have achieved. So there's 18% who've completed Part 3. This is about 41% across these two, which is completed Part 2, broken down to whether or not they're intending on studying further or not. So I think it's actually quite a good breakdown of different levels of qualification. There's quite a few in there as well who just studied a university degree and have no intention of doing anything else. I'm really interested in their results as well. As a lecturer, I'm delivering an education to these students whether or not they become an actuary afterwards. And so it's important for me to know that I'm delivering them an education that's relevant to whatever work they end up in. Prior duration of English education, universities have lots and lots and lots of international students, and I thought this could be an interesting predictive variable for some of the other questions later on. You'll see that less than 50% have completed all of their education in the English language before starting actuarial education. That, I would imagine, would be an underrepresentation of the types of students that we get at ANU. You see up here, around 20% or so have done 2 years or less of English education before starting an actuarial degree, which is a pretty scary thought. Actuarial studies is hard enough without trying to learn it in a language that's different to your native language. So where do students do part one? About 80% through an undergraduate degree, 10% through a postgraduate degree, 10% through the UK exams. And this is a breakdown of where we got the respondents from in terms of university. So ANU is a little bit less than 50%. Macquarie is about 25%. They were the two alumni mailing lists we were able to get access to. It's nice to see that both Melbourne and UNSW have got over 10%, even though we didn't have access to their alumni lists. Has anyone got any questions at all? Okay, results. Much more fun. Let's stop here for a moment and try to actually work out what's going on, because there's a lot happening on this slide. So first thing we've asked is, how useful do you feel that the Part 1 subjects are in your current role? The Part 1 subjects you can see down the left-hand side of this slide, along with some names for those who have forgotten what Part 1 subjects exist, which is perfectly fine. I do not expect you to remember. Now, we did also do some factor analysis to see if any of these results were predicted by some of the demographic factors I showed you. I'm not going to present that. We did some ordinal logistic regressions. Most of it didn't really show that there was any difference between the different demographics, but I'll talk about a couple as we go along. We also asked open-ended questions at the end of all these as well. I'm not going to go through the open-ended questions except in a couple of instances where it's really, really interesting. So we asked, please comment on your answer to this question or something like that. Okay, now what do we get out of this? Not a huge amount, I think. There's not really any clear subject that's really, really good or really, really bad. All of the subjects are rated as being over 50% at least moderately useful. CT5's the worst, contingencies. That's only got just over 50% saying that it was at least moderately useful. Now, the first thing that popped out to me when I saw this was like, okay, well, is this influenced by area of employment? Because that's a pretty logical question to ask. Now, there's so many different areas of employment that we need to get a big enough sample to be able to do some sensible analysis. We do have enough in general insurance and life insurance to do that. So let's have a look at the same question, but for those who are working in general insurance. Okay, they hate contingencies. Not useful at all. Only about 35% said it was at least moderately useful. They love statistical methods, which is the course that includes stuff like generalized linear modelling, chain ladders, risk theory, and you know, all the obvious stuff for someone working in general insurance. What about life insurance? Okay, now life insurance actuaries love contingencies. Surprise, surprise. Insert sarcasm for people listening to this later on. So what have we learnt from this question? And I've been pondering this for a while, and I think that what I've learnt from this question is that there's not going to, if we want to consolidate the Part 1 syllabus for whatever reason, there's not an easy fix as to just take this subject out, just take that subject out. There's no, yeah, you can't just get rid of CT5, for example. That's not really going to work. Now, for a completely personal view on this issue, and perhaps controversial, I don't think the actual material in Part 1 matters that much, to be perfectly honest, what's in there. What I think is important is that we're teaching students how to learn and how to think quantitatively with respect to business problems. If there's something in Part 1 that's not actually, sorry, if there's something they don't learn in Part 1 that they need later on, if we've taught them well enough, they can learn it for themselves. So that's my personal view, but that may be different to others' views. Does anyone want to offer any comments? Trice. Yes, please do.
It's Janice from PwC. I get that people might learn it themselves later, but we've got a team that works across all specialties in Perth, as we would have to, and what we often find is someone will come into a meeting going, oh, I saw that, I've seen that technique, I think it might work here. And if you haven't done all the techniques, you might never realise what you're missing. And that would be my concern, particularly if someone's not working in a big team with a lot of backgrounds. They might just not realise that contingencies techniques would be useful. Mm. They wouldn't even look. So that'd be my concern.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point. I go back to what I originally said, saying we can't get rid of anything carte blanche. Like, but within CT5, whether you include this or that is probably not that important, in my opinion. Let's move on.
Can I just comment? Sorry.
Yes.
I just wanted to say that I actually agree with you, Adam, that I think it's about the learning process and the learning styles. I hear what you're saying, Janice, and I think that's true, that I wouldn't be suggesting taking things out. But I think we can get a little bit hung up at times about the detail of this must be in, but we need to have exposure across the board.
Being actuaries, we get hung up.
The question from Phil, who's unfortunately lost his voice, was what was in CT5?
Yeah, it's contingencies taught with a life focus. So it's stuff like life tables, multiple decrement tables, annuity valuations and premium calculations and things like that. Okay, let's move on. We also asked about the quality of Part 1 education. This did have some differences across universities. I am not going to present that in this presentation. As fun as it might be to really, really cause a ruckus. So you've got, again, the options down the left-hand side, and then five options from significant strength down to significant weakness. Again, there's nothing massively jumping out here. Feedback from teachers and from peers is not rated particularly highly compared to the other options. I suspect that's a function of large undergraduate university classes making feedback more difficult to do. It's possible, but it's harder in a bigger class. We also asked about the amount of material in the Part 1 syllabus. And I think this is an interesting question because I have so many conversations with academics whinging about how much material there is in the Part 1 syllabus and how it's so difficult to cover everything. And the students are basically telling us that it's about right. And I think the reason for that is that the amount of material in the syllabus from a student's perspective is not too bad. Lecturers would love to add other stuff, which I'll talk about later on, but they feel like there's not enough space to do that. So from the student's point of view, they don't necessarily feel overburdened by the Part 1 syllabus, but the lecturers feel like they'd like to add more material. But more on that later. Okay, Part 2 now. Same question that we asked before, the quality of the elements of Part 2. What we see here is that feedback is a little better than it was for the Part 1 question. The rest of the results, on average, Part 2 is viewed as being better than Part 1. Now, this is not really a fair comparison, though, because what we've got here is a cohort of students who've done Part 2 compared to a cohort of students who've done Part 1. Part 2 is a subset, obviously, of Part 1. To get a fair comparison, we really need to compare only those who've done both Part 1 and Part 2 and compare the results for Part 1 with the results for Part 2. Now, the cool thing is I can do that on the next slide, and because the format of the slide is identical, we can switch back and forth and back and forth nice and quickly and see the bars change. So this is the same question for Part 1, but only looking at those who've done Part 2 as well. And what we're looking for is how those bars move and in what direction they move. What we're seeing is that the good bars, this cyan bar at the top and purple, I think it's cyan, it sounds impressive anyway, are getting lower for Part 2. Pretty much across the board, Part 2 is viewed as being more, well, higher quality than Part 1. We're going to talk about the difference between Part 1 and Part 2 in a little more detail in a moment. Okay, Part 2. the amount of syllabus in part two, the amount of material in the syllabus, almost exactly the same as for part one, viewed as being pretty much about right. Okay, now we get into the interesting stuff, and the next question I think is pretty important in terms of the results that we got. So we asked an open-ended question right at the end of this section of the survey, asking students to comment on the appropriateness or otherwise of the relationship between part two and part one. What you can see below that is a word cloud. Michelle Salmona, who is one of the authors of the paper, is not an actuary, which is good, because what she did is she coded all of these open-ended responses, which basically means that she attached one or more themes to each of the responses. And this word cloud basically represents the most common themes. The bigger the phrase, the more commonly it came up. Now, the good thing about Michelle not being an actuary is that she wasn't biased by what she thought the results were going to be. The two words, well, the two phrases that are the biggest are this here, which is expanding out, linking technical part one and practical part two, and here, real-world practical application for materials. The other two biggest, practical, gap. Gap refers to the gap between part one and part two. It seems like these comments are all talking about contextual application of material in some way or another. Now, what I did after seeing this is I went through the open-ended questions and tried to find a couple of representative quotes, because this is good, but it'd be nice to see like a full sentence. So I can't claim that this is not biased, but I did my best. No, actually, I can claim that I did my best not to make it biased, but here's a couple of what I think are representative quotes from this question. I think they're really interesting. This is quite positive, this one, and I'll read it out. I feel it is a very good split between technical skills where the answers are black and white and the practical, less strict applications of these skills in part two. Though we don't actually apply the technical processes from part one, that's scary. So we don't actually apply the technical processes from part one. Part two genuinely helped to bridge the gap and helped me develop a sense of clarity with regards to how the skills I learned will add value to business problems. Okay, so it's very positive in terms of part two. Now, let's have a look at another one which thematically is very similar, but it's not as positive. So there wasn't a clear relationship between the two. Part one was very focused on actuarial techniques and part two was focused on actuarial management. There wasn't really a connection in applying actuarial skills to the real world. It was also somewhat difficult to study part two after having 3 years of mostly mathematical subjects. Perhaps part two could be integrated more closely with part one so that for those undertaking 4 years of undergraduate study, you don't have such a huge difference between the types of subjects studied in third year compared to fourth year. For those who are relatively close to their education, I see a few young faces around, including some ANU, ex-ANU students. Does that match your experience? This came up all the time in the open-ended comments, this gap between part one and part two. There was a strong view that it was the transition from part one to part two was really difficult, and that making that transition smoother by making some of the part one content more contextual would have really smoothed that transition, and that came up over and over and over again. So I think that's one of the key things that I've learnt from this survey. Any questions or comments at all? Microphone.
Hi, Mike Callan, Monash. Is that just reflecting the shock that students have, that many of them come in to do actuarial work thinking it's mathematical, and then they hit the part twos and it's not mathematical?
Absolutely, absolutely it is, but that shock is exacerbated by the structure of the courses, I think, in the sense that part one is very, very, very mathematical, and then part two is very non-mathematical. Any other questions or comments? Yeah.
Donald Campbell, occasionally at University of Melbourne. I actually take part of the part two course at University of Melbourne, the superannuation part of the course, and I completely agree with these comments. The students coming into my class every year have a shock. It's slightly exacerbated for my part of the course because none of the superannuation stuff that I teach directly relates to anything in part one. Contingencies has some of the technical skills, but there's a hell of a lot to learn. There's a big jump, and we seem to spend more time each year trying to get students up to speed. I'm almost ashamed to admit that I never really thought about fixing part one to make it easier. We've been trying to, being a part two lecturer, we've been trying to make the jump into part two smooth, as smooth as we can while still getting through the syllabus. But this, I mean, if this was possible, as this student says, would be difficult to change though. But if we can, it would make my life easier and the lives of all my future students easier to not have to face that massive shock, as you say. It is a big shock for all my students, even the ones that speak fluent English, but especially the ones that don't.
Before you sit down, is there something specific that you can give us as an example of what could be helpful in part one to make part two easier?
Having only just thought about it for 2 minutes, I really want to think about some more, but I would say two things. One is requiring the use of English explanations in answers to part one. So having, and also having answers to part one questions not be purely mathematical. The first things I say to my students are, this course is different. It is much more like part three than part one. There is no one right answer. To any question I ask you in this course, there will never be one right answer. The answer is always depends. It depends on the context. It depends on everything around the question. And we don't ask that many mathematical questions because we are trying to get you across that gap to the real world where there aren't any pure answers. So that would be my tip. Non-mathematical questions somehow. And that's difficult because where do you fit it in part one? But also, yeah, starting them to have to explain context and explain their reasoning and their judgment.
Thank you. We're going to hear a little bit more about that later on, so let's move on. I asked some questions about part three as well. I'm going to skip through this relatively quickly, partly because I don't feel as qualified to talk about part three as I do about part one and part two. I have been involved in part three, but not to the extent as I've been involved in part one and part two. The other challenge with the part three questions is that the respondents, well, there weren't that many of them for starters. A lot of the respondents haven't got to part three yet. Secondly, a lot of them have done different courses. And we didn't ask a separate set of questions for if you'd done module one, if you've done CAP, if you've done life insurance. The survey was long enough as it was. So these are a little difficult to interpret, but there's a couple of things that are worthwhile pointing out. So feedback is not viewed very highly in part three, possibly unsurprisingly. The syllabus itself is viewed pretty well, so the actual content is viewed quite highly. It's the rest of the teaching aspects, I guess, that are not viewed as highly. We asked about the amount of material in the part three syllabus. I don't think this is surprising either to see that more are saying that there's too much in part three. It wasn't that long ago for me that I remember studying part three and working at the same time. It's not fun. It's hard work. So this is not really surprising. We also asked about the link between the three parts in a similar sort of way between part two and part one. I haven't got a word cloud here because a lot of students wanted to answer from the perspective of one particular course, which is not particularly helpful. But there's a couple of open-ended responses that I wanted to highlight that were reasonably representative. So this is interesting. This was in relation to this question, but it actually really goes back more to the part one, part two thing, though I think it would help if the part one were tailored to link to practical reality as well. This is a good one, and it's long, but I'll try and pick out the key bits. Part three is an excellent way to learn how to combine technical skills and business advice, in particular CAP. It teaches communication and how actuaries can really add value in an organisation, combination of strong technical abilities and ability to interpret results. I won't read the rest. You can read it yourself. The key thing that came out of this question is that the students, or the graduates, generally viewed part three as being very appropriate from a purpose point of view. There was strong support for the general structure of part one, part two, part three as being appropriate for that transition to fellowship. Obviously, there's some issues between part one and part two, the transition, but in general, part three was viewed quite highly from its purpose point of view. Uh, Okay, this is where we get to the question that you may have had a look at already. So the last thing we asked about in the survey was the importance of non-technical skills, and this comes back to what you were talking about earlier, I think, in terms of integrating the context with the technical material. We asked three questions. We firstly asked about the importance of non-technical skills, then we asked about how well it was taught, and then we asked about where it should be taught. Now, the categories down the left-hand side were inspired by the Actuaries Institute's capability framework. They were sourced from the Society of Actuaries competency framework, which is a much, 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 much smaller and easier to get your head around version than the Actuaries Institute's capability framework. I won't say any more about that. Okay, so I think what's interesting here is that everything is viewed as being important. And the way we framed the question was what the importance of non-technical skills to your role now and potentially in the future. So we wanted respondents to look forward. The only one of these that doesn't have at least 50% significant importance is leadership. Everything else, and even then, over 85% say moderate importance or significant importance. So the respondents viewed these things as being important. I suspect there's a bias in this question in particular because of the sort of people who would actually answer a survey are probably the sort of people who are thinking about their career as well. Then we asked about how well these non-technical skills were taught. Now, I need to note something first. There's a lovely little typo here. That should be a P, not a PS. So this is problem solving, this is professionalism, and the same for all the other ones as well. How well were things taught? We'll start with part one. I love the difference between this and this. I know they're different widths for some reason or other, but the difference in the purple lines between this and this, the rows down the bottoms are exactly the same. So essentially, apart from problem solving, part one is viewed as not teaching any of these non-technical skills really at all. Problem solving, not too bad. About 70% say reasonably well or very well. Part two, much better. So part two is viewed as teaching really everything except for leadership more than 50% or at least around 50% reasonably well or very well, except for leadership. Leadership's an interesting one here. Part three has sort of similar results to part two, except for things like oral communication because there really isn't any oral communication in part three. And teamwork as well is not viewed particularly as being developed within part three. Now, it's really important to note that this is not a judgment question about where things should be taught. That's the next question. What we're asking here is whether it was taught and how well it was taught. Now we move on to the where it should be taught. And this is the question you would have answered if you got your phone or tablet out. Okay, so there's a lot going on here. Let me explain. The categories are the same. Got a whole bunch of columns, which are the non-technical skills. The way this question was framed is that you could choose or not choose to fill in any box. So within written communication, for example, you could choose 0, 1, 2, 3, or any of these boxes if you wanted to. And the same for all of these other ones as well. These numbers here just represent the proportion of respondents who ticked that box. The denominator in this instance was just the number of people who ticked at least one box in the whole question. We sort of figured if you didn't tick a box anywhere, you probably actually weren't answering the question, and we're just trying to get to the end to get a chance of winning a prize. Now, what are these numbers telling us? There's a lot going on here. There's a few things that jump out at me. Firstly, if you compare the integrated and the module rows, the integrated are much higher. So the view seems to be that teaching non-technical skills integrated with subjects that already exist is a better way than having a communications course, for example, which I would agree with. But where it should be taught, this is all over the place, absolutely all over the place, which I guess is not surprising. There's nothing that's higher than 50%. Part two seems to be a little higher than part one on average. I thought of a number of different ways of condensing this data into something different. And one way I thought was, okay, what if we just looked at the proportion of people who said at least one option in any of these six rows here to try and get a feel for, okay, you think that it should be taught somewhere in formal actuarial education, but there's no clear answer as to where. My co-authors didn't necessarily agree that that was appropriate given the way we worded the question. We had a fun discussion. But if you do that, then all of these except for leadership come up as having at least 50% of respondents choosing one of the six rows within part one, two, or three, which I think is interesting, but leadership is below 50%. So that's the results from the respondents. What about your results? Who did it, by the way? Can you chuck your hand up if you actually answered the survey? Yeah, it's enough people to get something meaningful. Now we've just got to work out how to... Oh, I did this before. That's what we need to do. No, it's not. This is fun, isn't it, watching the presenter not work out how to use the computer? That's it. That's what we need. Okay, let's refresh this. No responses, before we started. I just need to... Doesn't update automatically. Okay, so this is going to look completely different to what we saw before. It's not in the same format. There are some numbers down the bottom, I think, which are going to be much easier to interpret. Okay, we need to reverse the rows and the columns because that's the way SurveyMonkey is presenting it. So this is written communication, oral communication. Let's make it bigger so you can actually see it. Except that's not working. That's better. Okay. This is better when we can see these rows. Okay, so we're seeing the same thing about integration here. These numbers all seem much higher than the modules. Part one, part two, part three, again, I think the part two numbers are higher than part one. These seem relatively consistent with what we just saw. Given that there were 14 respondents, pardon me, we're seeing a lot of numbers above 50% here, which is interesting. No, I'm fine, thanks. It's just a cough that I'm trying to get rid of, but thank you. So I think these results are reasonably consistent with what we saw, except there's probably a stronger positive view about teaching these non-technical skills within part two, definitely. So let's go back to the presentation. There we go. Okay, conclusions. Now, we've learned a few things, I think, out of this exercise, and we want to do some further work. Firstly, what technical material should we include in part one? That's really an open question. That's largely going to be driven by things outside of the Actuaries Institute's control. The International Actuarial Association has just released a new draft syllabus, which is going to influence the member country associations, will be influenced by the UK. I don't think we necessarily have a lot of control over that first bullet point, but it's certainly an open question. How to manage the transition between part one and part two? Big issue, based on the survey. Improvement in delivery, although not necessarily the content of part three, that's been an ongoing discussion for a long time in the Institute. And then the appropriate location, if any, for teaching of non-technical skills. I actually think that this and this are actually really related to each other. Essentially, you can deal with both of these concurrently by teaching non-technical skills, perhaps at least exposure in part one, then that will actually help you manage the transition between part one and part two. What we're doing now in terms of using the rest of the Institute's money is we're looking at what other professions do in this area. Actuaries can be a little insular, I think, and I think there's a lot to learn from what the accounting profession, shock horror, does in this area and the engineering profession, which are probably the two most closely related big professional associations. So we've got someone looking at the literature on that and how that might influence our thinking in actuarial education. That's about all I wanted to say, so I would encourage comments, thoughts, questions, debate, etc. Thank you.
Thanks, Adam. Can I just encourage some questions?
Man, he'd be up here straight away.
Hey, do you think... I know who you are. Oh, sorry, Aaron from ANU. And I love Adam to bits. do you think universities have the risk of just being sausage factories?
Okay, that's really, really hard to answer. Because I'm not... The way I would like to answer the question, I don't think directly relates to what I've talked about, which is not necessarily a problem, but the way I want to answer the question... Because when I think about that term, my initial instinct is churning out perhaps more supply than what's required, which is an issue for another conversation. And you know what? I'm just going to actually... Your question was very brief and open-ended, so my answer to your question is going to be no.
My name's Jeff Rashbrook. I'm really here because I find myself responsible for a Macquarie graduate who's done part one and most of part one and all of part two, and is now working for me in Fiji for the Fiji National Provident Fund. And I'm trying to work out what I can give her, how I develop her, how I make sure she has the responsible. And I'm slightly stuck because when I did the exams, we did the equivalent of part one, but we did it at work. It was very rare for anybody to actually do it at university. It was just coming in around about the time I qualified. So we picked up practical competencies at the same time as we were doing learning the technical skills. Then we went on to what you'd now call part three. There was no sort of bridging stage. My question kind of is, do you think you've actually got structure right in terms of giving people the practical experience that they can relate what they are learning to what they are doing, and also those of us who then find themselves trying to inculcate these students into the workforce, where are we going to get the help?
Okay, that's a great question. And to address the first part, the situation we've now got is that we have a UK syllabus that basically the Actuaries Institute says to us, you need to teach this. And we've got this really strange situation where essentially what an 18-year-old student does who's come straight out of high school is identical to what someone does who is working in the UK or in Australia and does the exam through the UK, which is ridiculous because, as you said, the student in the UK who has got work experience already makes those practical connections themselves at work. An 18-year-old university student's got no chance of making those connections. So I would argue that the accreditation or the syllabus or whatever you want to call it process that the universities are under needs to identify that in some way. I'm not 100% sure what the best way of identifying that is, but the 18-year-old student doesn't have the context. Now, your second question, which was how do employers support that, I've got no idea. I mean, I haven't thought about that a huge amount, but it's something that employers need to think about, obviously. They'll be getting fairly raw material out of our undergraduate courses in a lot of instances, so employers need to be aware of that. I don't really have a comment as to how they deal with it.
Any more? Can I encourage some more? Yeah. Thanks.
Jessica Twigg from the NDIA, and I'm a former ANU grad. I just wanted to make a comment about the gap between part one and part two. From the flip side, of somebody who is perhaps stronger in those non-technical areas and the communication side of things and the practical application, it's very clear with the dropout rates in part one that if you could integrate some of those more practical things into the part one syllabus, you might be able to keep some of those people in those early subjects.
Thank you. I mean, you're right. I think it's very important, though, that we keep part one technically difficult, very, very important. So I'm not sure what impact it would have in integrating some of the more practical elements, because in some senses this is going to sound really heartless, but I want people to drop out that aren't capable, because I mean they're in the wrong degree, so I don't want them to finish a three-year undergraduate degree and then have got 55 in every subject and have, they can't get an actuarial job, they're struggling to get a job in more general financial areas because they've got this degree that maybe an employer doesn't understand that's got 55s all over it. So I'm all for... I mean, we have a process at ANU that identifies these students and we have a conversation with them about what their options are. So anyway, that's my comment.
Anybody else want to make a quick response to that? We've got two. One of you, and then we'll have the other question then. I'm sorry, we're going to have to finish.
I'm Tracy Poldor, Towers Watson. As part of my role at Towers Watson, I interview quite a few students each year, and we actually have a... we take interns over sort of Christmas, New Year period. So I also interview people while they are at uni as well. So, and I find just so many don't have any idea what actuaries do and are quite open about that. And I interview them on the way out of Towers Watson after their sort of 2 month stay. So from that point of view, I think it would be good to integrate the part twos because I think they'd get a bit more, they're not going to see it completely, but they'll get a bit more of an inkling about what actuaries do. So I see it as a positive thing.
Thank you.
Great, thank you.
What's going on?
Hi, I'm Andrea Glass. I've been working with the staff at Victoria University in Wellington, which is just setting up their first actuarial major there, which they're doing for both a science degree and a commerce degree. And one of the things that they've chosen to do is only offer 6 subjects for the exemption and to encourage students to take papers from other areas of the courses available at the university. And that's following a decision made, I think, by their School of Engineering and Computer Science to require students to take subjects outside the faculty. Any thought to doing that? They seem to think that it does, you know, along the lines of the previous comments, actually it's actually better for the students to be doing some papers that make them think in a different way.
That's certainly an option. Yeah, there's a number of options. That's one option. I know certain universities require that as a whole, like the whole university. I mean, Macquarie does something sort of similar to that. I mean, it depends on what subject you take as well. I guess the slight danger is that students will take the easy option and just try and find the cheapest way of satisfying the requirements. And I don't blame students for doing that. I probably would have done that myself.
Yeah, no, my current boss was telling me a lovely story about how he managed to take beginner mathematics as his special, yeah, his non-core subject for his actuarial science degree.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to wind it up there. But please thank Adam for me. And if you have any input on part 1, part 2, I'd be really interested in having a chat with people beyond here. So thank you.